Hi, this is Rob Nadelson, and welcome to How the Supreme Court Rewrote the Constitution, 1937 to 1944. This is part five, and it's entitled, Killing Economic Freedom. The Constitution granted Congress significant but limited economic powers. They included passing, quote, uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies, coining money, controlling the currency, fixing weights and measures, establishing post offices, establishing post roads, which is a founding era term for intercity highways, issuing patents and copyrights, governing federal enclaves and territories, and finally, regulating commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. This is the Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. In addition, the Necessary and Proper Clause, which is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, recognized Congress's prerogative of passing laws necessary and proper for carrying out other powers. The vast expansion in federal economic authority during the years 1937 to 1944 was made possible by the Supreme Court decisions rewriting the two clauses that, working together, create Congress's commerce power, that is, the Commerce Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause. To understand how the court mangled these provisions, we first must understand their original meanings. When the Constitution gave Congress authority to, quote, regulate commerce, the phrase meant passing laws on the purchase and sale of products and some traditionally associated activities, such as navigation and cargo insurance in ships. Commerce excluded other economic activities, including production, manufacturing, agriculture, mining. It excluded real estate transactions, most kinds of insurance. It also excluded non-economic activities, such as crimes of passion, or issues of marriage and divorce, of religion or morality. The Constitution left oversight of all those activities to the states. The Commerce Clause also limited Congress to supervising commerce across political borders. Congress could regulate the sale of shoes by a North Carolina wholesaler to a New York retailer, but only New York state government could oversee a New York retailer's sale to a New York buyer. Those who wrote and adopted the Constitution thoroughly understood that economic and non-economic activities all affect each other. They're all interdependent. If a wheat grower has a bumper crop, it affects the price of wheat in commerce. Similarly, the price of wheat may influence the grower's decision to buy more land or to marry or to have children. In the 1930s, progressives often claimed that because of interdependence, the federal government should regulate everything, or at least all economic activities. They seemed to think the founders didn't understand interdependence or that it was something new. A good example is the quotation I read in the second installment of this series from Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes. But interdependence was nothing new, and the founders fully understood it. In fact, they talked a great deal about it. Still, when writing the Constitution, they split responsibility between the states and the central government. They did so because other values, such as freedom, are more important than central coordination. However, the founders qualified the split of responsibility. In other words, they allowed a certain blurring of responsibility with the Necessary and Proper Clause. That clause is too complicated to cover here. Several co-authors and I have written a whole book on the subject. Suffice to say here that the Necessary and Proper Clause allowed Congress to govern some activities that were not exactly commerce, but were subordinate to it. The technical term was incidental to it. For example, the Commerce Clause allowed Congress to regulate the shipment of goods across state lines, and the Necessary and Proper Clause permitted Congress to regulate how the goods were labeled for the journey. Labeling was not technically part of commerce, it was part of manufacturing, but it was a lesser activity incidental to commerce. The third installment of this series discussed Chief Justice Hughes' opinion in the case of National Labor Relations Board versus Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation. Hughes said that Congress could regulate labor relations, which are part of production rather than commerce, in a very large interstate company to prevent an obstruction to commerce. Hughes' opinion reveals that he was relying on the Necessary and Proper Clause, although he didn't use the name. But for the Necessary and Proper Clause to allow Congress to regulate an activity, it's not enough that the activity obstruct or otherwise affect commerce. The activity also, under the Necessary and Proper Clause, must be subordinate or incidental to commerce. And labor relations are far too important for that. They're very much an independent subject. Ultimately, Hughes' attempted compromise gave more extreme progressives a vehicle for destroying the limits on the Federal Commerce Clause entirely. Retirements from the Supreme Court after the Jones and Laughlin case allowed President Roosevelt to place New Deal supporters on the bench. The previous installment in this series mentioned Hugo Black, who came to the bench in 1937, and Stanley Reed in 1938. Benjamin Cardozo was replaced by Felix Frankfurter in 1938, and Louis Brandeis by the far-left William O. Douglas in 1939. The conservative Pierce Butler was replaced by FDR's Attorney General, Frank Murphy, also in 1939, and in 1941, James McReynolds, the last true conservative activist on the court, was supplanted by James Byrne, a pro-New Deal senator. Also in 1941, Hughes retired. FDR moved the more liberal associate Justice Harlan Fiske Stone up to Chief Justice, and then he filled Stone's slot with Robert Jackson, who had succeeded Murphy as Attorney General. So by 1942, the court's makeup stood as follows. Liberals, 9. Conservatives, 0. In February 1941, the court handed down United States versus Darby. The Darby Lumber Company was a Georgia enterprise far smaller than the Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation. The issue was whether federal labor law was enforceable against this smaller entity. Chief Justice Stone's meandering opinion appears to have relied on the Necessary and Proper Clause, but it never mentioned that clause by name. Stone cited Chief Justice Hughes' decision in Jones and Laughlin, but he ignored the fact that Hughes' decision was limited to much larger companies. Stone added that Congress could regulate any production with a substantial effect on commerce, but he never defined substantial effect. Jones further said Congress may regulate production that is, get this, so related to the commerce and so affecting it as to be within the power of Congress to regulate it. So related to the commerce and so affecting it as to be within the power of Congress to regulate it. Apparently, he wasn't aware that this statement is circular. Constitutionally, the portions of the Darby case just discussed were, frankly, inane. But they gave a relative handful of federal politicians almost absolute power over every business in America. The court's 1942 case, Wickard versus Filburn, naturally followed from Darby. Roscoe C. Filburn was a farmer. He grew wheat. Pursuant to a New Deal program, the federal government imposed a maximum wheat quota. Roscoe Filburn didn't sell more than the quota, but he grew some extra to use on his own farm. The government fined him, and the court unanimously upheld the fine. Justice Jackson's opinion acknowledged that Filburn's raising wheat for home consumption was not commerce. But Jackson relied on the Darby case and said that Congress could regulate Filburn's decision because his decision, when amalgamated with many others like it, had a substantial effect on commerce. Like Hughes before him, Jackson also misrepresented comments by Chief Justice John Marshall. Justice Jackson wrote, quote, "At the beginning, Chief Justice Marshall described the federal commerce power with a breadth never yet exceeded. In Gibbons versus Ogden, Marshall made emphatic the embracing and penetrating nature of this power by warning that effective restraints on its exercise must proceed from political rather than from judicial processes. In other words, don't look to us, it's all up to Congress. Here are some facts, though. First, Chief Justice Marshall never permitted congressional control over production under the pretense that it affected commerce. In Gibbons versus Ogden, the case mentioned by Jackson, decided in 1824, the court addressed navigation, and navigation was a subject within the core of the Commerce Clause. Moreover, in the same case, Marshall listed activities outside the scope of federal power, including some that substantially affect commerce. And finally, Marshall never said effective restraints must proceed from political rather than judicial processes. On the contrary, in McCulloch versus Maryland, he affirmed explicitly that if Congress exceeded its authority, quote, it would become the painful duty of this tribunal to say that such an act was not the law of the land. Justice Jackson's conduct in Wickard could only be described as duplicity, and that duplicity was exceeded only by Justice Black's in the 1944 case of United States versus Southeastern Underwriters Association. Southeastern Underwriters overruled long-standing Supreme Court precedent to hold that Congress may regulate all forms of insurance because all of them, not just cargo insurance, are commerce. Jack's opinion, Black's opinion for a unanimous court was a classic example of judicial mendacity. Again, it helps to itemize. First, Black claimed 18th century, quote, dictionaries, encyclopedias, and other books, end quote, defined commerce to include all forms of insurance. Yet Justice Black failed to cite a single dictionary, encyclopedia, or book saying that. And it's obvious why. Because there are none. Secondly, Black cited a report by Alexander Hamilton, but failed to reveal that Hamilton's report referred only to cargo insurance, which was traditionally within the commerce power. Thirdly, Black referenced Marshall's Gibbons versus Ogden opinion to, quote, prove that insurance is a form of commerce. Actually, Marshall never mentioned insurance in that case. And finally, Black cited a thinly documented 1937 book claiming that commerce includes all economic activities. But this claim is rebutted by the text of the Constitution itself, which lists other economic activities separately. When we consider the enormous scope of the current federal regulatory regime, we do well to remember that the ultimate constitutional justification for most of it consists of the Supreme Court's mendacious ruling in Southeast Underwriters and the vague substantial effects language from Darby and Wickard, a flimsy foundation indeed.